God, what is it that you would like me to share with these women? And so I decided that in order to perhaps gain some credibility with those who don't know me and haven't heard my story, that I would just begin by listing some of the transitions that I have experienced in the last 5 years. And as I went through this, I realized that actually the majority of these have happened in the last 18 months. But this will give you a snapshot of who I am and what my life has looked like. So within the last 5 years, I ended the job that I had done and that Val referred to, that was with almost 20 years with one company, being a career coach and instructor and helping people navigate through vocational and job shifts. That career ended because of the intense pain that I was experiencing in my jaw. And so I could no longer speak, I could no longer teach, I could no longer really do pretty much anything that I had typically done in life. That began a period of 2 years of waiting for surgery, which I ended up needing to move to Mississauga for. And my husband and I lived in Mississauga for 2 months when I had total joint replacement surgery on my jaw. At the time, we didn't know if I would actually survive the surgery because I have another underlying medical condition that made it more complicated. And what needed to be done meant that there would be plates put in the joint with screws that were going within 2 millimeters of my brain cavity. So there was also a potential for some damage or some issues that would have been beyond the just the surgery. Thank the Lord. Here I am, I'm speaking, and it was a miraculous experience, actually. But it took 18 months to recover. So I spent 18 months pretty much at home after the 2 years I had spent at home trying to understand what it meant to have a ministry of obscurity. Because I had gone from being out in the public, I had gone from enjoying interacting with people to even the act of smiling causing so much pain that it made me just cringe. So the recovery time was about 18 months. During that time, our 3 sons, who are now 27, almost 26, and almost 24, left home. And then they came back, and then they left home, and then they came back, and then they left home. And if you have children in that age stage, you know that that's just what happens. I think I can confidently say that they have left home. But we'll see. All 3 of them, within the last 5 years, graduated from university. Our first son got engaged. That same son's engagement broke off about 3 months before the wedding. During this time, I wrote a book on change and transitions. That book was published about a year ago and released about a year ago. Our third son got engaged and eventually got married, just got married a year ago. I started up my consulting business again, wondering what God had in store, because the position that I had been in before no longer existed, so it was brand new territory. There was a whole shift in what was I going to be when I grew up. Then I found out when our second son came home one day and told us that he was going to be a dad. He is not married. And so that was a shift and a new set of circumstances, and I'm actually going to talk a little bit more about that on Sunday when I have the opportunity to share here in church. I began work 18 months ago with Food for the Hungry, which is an incredible God story in and of itself. You would not necessarily at first glance think Food for the Hungry connects with career and life coaching. It very much does. And I was amazed at the way that God put those pieces together. I've traveled to Manitoba to help my parents move off their farm area into a seniors complex. My husband and I drove there. We spent 5 16-hour days going through a lifetime of their possessions and helping them transition. I've traveled to Cambodia to see one of our Food for the Hungry communities. I mentioned our third son got married a year ago. Just to give you an idea in terms of travel, I have been through the Calgary airport 29 times in 17 months. So that alone discounts or something. I actually think that I should see if I could just get a reserved chair. You know, this is where I come in, although they keep changing things. And so I'm landing and running and going in all different directions. That child that I mentioned that was mentioned to us in the spring and that we found out was going to be our grandson was born in October. And that experience of being a grandmother has just radically altered my life. He is a delightful little man. His name is Grayson. He's almost a year old. My parents visited from Manitoba at Christmas, and while they were visiting, my father had a stroke. In the process of that being diagnosed, they discovered that completely apart from the stroke, he had a brain tumor. And so they stabilized him. I flew back to Manitoba, or got them back to Manitoba. I flew to Calgary, got them on their plane, and then flew back. And then I flew to Manitoba for his brain surgery just about a month before I came to speak here at this church's retreat. Since then, I have been back to Manitoba to visit once. And since then, my husband's mother has had a stroke. So that's my life story of the last 5 years. Those are some of the highlights in 7 minutes or less. The one that I have left out, the one change, is that when I had that 8-hour surgery, the trauma of that much anesthetic threw my body into the mother of all changes called early menopause. And so thank you for having weather that allows me to wear sleeveless and sandals, because I am most comfortable without sweaters and things on at this stage of life. So that is probably not a list, unlike some of you have. And my guess is that there are at least several pieces from that list that you can say, oh yeah, that's my experience. I've experienced that kind of change as well. We're talking today about transitions and about navigating transitions. So what's the difference between change and transition? Because I think that's an important thing to acknowledge. Change is what goes on around us. Change is what happens externally. We can't avoid change. It's just a fact of life. Transition is what happens internally. Transition is what we do with all the things that are happening externally, all the things that are shifting. So how do we actually navigate in a way that keeps us sane, has grace attached to it, and honors God in the process? And I would say, from my years of working in this field and from my own experience, that navigating change in a healthy, God-honoring way requires three things. And isn't that convenient? You know, when you have a talk that requires three things, that seems to be a kind of a nice way to remember things. And two of them are very interchangeable. So, you know, we could talk about one first or the other. But let's start with self-awareness. Because if I'm going to navigate change in a way that is sustainable and in a way that is healthy, I need to know a little bit about who I am and how I even feel about change. So I'd like to just do a quick little exercise with you, have a bit of fun, and you'll notice on your tables that there are some pages that are flipped upside down. If you would each take a picture of the turtle, so you should have a nice little picture of this cute little turtle, and there should be some crayons, variety of different colors, and if you would just wait until I give you the instructions before you start coloring. So what I would like you to do this morning is grab a favorite color or two, and I would like you to color this picture disregarding the lines. So, did you catch that? I'd like you to please color this picture, disregarding the lines. Oh, you're awesome. Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. How are you doing? So one of the things, that I've learned about giving women an opportunity to color is that it's actually hard to get you back. But if I could have you back here for a moment. All right, ladies. I'd like you to, if you're able to color and listen at the same time, I'm completely fine with you doing that. I'd like to know, and if you're willing to just kind of shout it out, I'm interested to know what your first thought was when I gave you the directions or I gave you the instructions on the exercise. Yes. I can't do it, okay? Order, I heard. Sorry? It won't be pretty. Yes. Very uncomfortable. I'll what? I'll ruin the picture. I don't like this. So stressed. Oh, no stress. Okay. Whoosh. Yeah. You felt mischievous. Ooh. Love it. Yes? This will be fun. Yes. It's hard enough to follow your own rules. It's hard to break your own rules. Okay. Yes. A challenge. Ah, so this is my shameless plug for the session I'm doing tomorrow night. What you've just evidenced here are different personality styles, which is what we're going to be talking about tomorrow night. It's one of my favorite topics to speak about as well. Because how God has wired us in terms of our personality has a whole lot to do with how we handle change and how change hits us, if you will. What our first reaction is. Because essentially what this exercise does is it gives you an opportunity to change. I am bumping you up against all kinds of experiences that you've had, all kinds of maybe rules that you believe, all kinds of teachers or people in your life that have told you that this is the way something is supposed to be. And so what I hear in this room is a whole mix of how people respond to change. So some people, the response is, I love the challenge. Bring it on. Some people, the response is, change? Are you kidding me? I am not doing that. And the heels get dug in, and the sense of that is completely wrong. There are rules in place that give order and structure and control to the world. Don't mess with me. Don't mess with my order. I do not like chaos. Some of you probably experience some internal conflict around, but I've had all these people in my life who have told me that this is the way I'm supposed to color, and now she comes along and she says, I want you to do it this way, and I'd really like to do what she says, because I don't really want to disappoint her, but I really don't want to disappoint all these other people that are in my life who are wanting me to do things this other way, and so now I'm in conflict. I have an internal sense of, I don't know how to embrace this change because I don't want to disappoint other people. And then maybe there's somebody in the room who heard my instructions and said, finally, some freedom, some opportunity to be creative. Don't hem me in. I see fingers being pointed. It's her. That's what she likes. That's how she is. So where do you see yourself in that? Because as silly as it may sound, this little exercise can be an opportunity to get a little bit further insight into your own built-in, God-given personality, which gives you a certain propensity toward dealing with or understanding change. And how we navigate that will be different for each of us, but the process is sometimes frightening, sometimes exhilarating, and a lot of it will have to do with how we're hardwired. So when our kids were in their sort of early to mid-teen years, our one son came to me one day. He was about to turn 13, and we have been pretty careful with the kind of gifts that we give our kids over the years. We try not to have a lot of material kinds of accumulation, and we try to do experiential things if we can. And he came to me and he said, Mom, for my 13th birthday, I would love to have a hamster. And I smiled, and internally I thought, there will be over my dead body will we have a rodent in our house. That is not going to happen. And so I said, okay, well, that's interesting. I'll talk to your dad about that. And then I hoped that he would forget that he wanted a hamster. That's really, truly, seriously what I was hoping for. And then about a week later, he came to me and he said, Mom, about that hamster, I'm wondering if I could have a teddy bear hamster for my 13th birthday. And I said, well, you know, I'm not sure about that. It's a lot of work. And I don't want to be, you know, internally, I don't think I actually said this out loud. I'm thinking, I don't actually want to be the one doing this work. Because, you know, I don't want the novelty to wear off here and then all of a sudden it's my hamster. And he looks at me in all seriousness and he says, Mom, just so you know, having a hamster will teach me to be responsible and it'll make me a better father to your grandchildren someday. So Jimmy the hamster became part of our family a couple weeks later. And Jimmy actually taught me a whole lot about change and transition. Jimmy lived his existence in this little cage. And within the cage was this wheel. And about 10 o'clock at night, Jimmy would wake up. And of course, he couldn't end up living in our son's bedroom because he kept him awake. And so then he had to be out in the living room. And as these things go, bless you if you are hamster lovers. So he would start running. And he would run like he was on some sort of a marathon mission. And around and around and around we'd go, I think that little guy must have had unbelievable cardiovascular fitness. Because he would go and go and go and go. And every once in a while, he would just stop dead in his tracks. And it would just be like, and then he'd run again. And I watched him as my son would go and he would take him out of this world and he would put him in one of those plastic globes. You know the globes? Yeah. So he'd lock him in there and he'd set him on the ground and Jimmy would move into a complete state of fear and paralysis. And he would just be frozen in this globe. And then you could see that his muscles would start to twitch. And he couldn't maintain this posture of frozenness any longer. And so the muscle would twitch and the ball would move a little bit. And then it would twitch a little bit more and it would move a little bit. And then, and this happened every time. A little bit of a slow learner, I have to say. And so the ball would move a little bit and then it was like, oh, there's something else going on here. And he would move a foot and then, or are they paws? I don't know what we would call them. And pause, and then all of a sudden, the momentum built. And he would take off. And we actually had to block the top of the stairs because he was just flying around the house. And it was like this whole new world opened up to him. But what did it take in order for him to enter into the excitement of this whole new world? It took some sort of radical intervention of our son picking him up and taking him out of his comfortable existence and putting him into something that initially felt very uncomfortable. And it took a lot of courage for him, and sometimes just, you know, muscle spasms, for him to take that first step. And you know, I don't feel much different than Jimmy. I am aware that at times I would much rather stay in my hamster wheel and just keep doing what I'm doing. And there are times where God says, no, something different. And the change happens, and then I am responsible to know myself and to know that I need to be surrounded by a community who can help me navigate those kinds of changes. So I'm curious how you feel about change. And I wonder if perhaps you might see yourself in this story. So this is a story about a Navy ship that's out on maneuvers. The weather turns bad and the sea is rough and fog descends. And you may feel like that has happened to you in your life. Things get rough, and this fog of uncertainty and change and the known becoming the unknown sets in. The captain of the Navy ship is on the bridge, and he receives a message. We can just make out a light on the starboard bow, Captain. And he replies, is it steady or moving astern? It's steady, Captain. Then send this message. We are on a collision course. Alter your course 15 degrees north. The message comes back. You move 15 degrees south. The captain is irritated and says, send this message. I am a captain. Move 15 degrees now. A message comes back. I am an able seaman. You move 15 degrees. The captain is furious and says, send this message. This is the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln, second largest ship in the U.S. Atlantic Fleet. I demand that you change your course 15 degrees north or countermeasures will be taken to ensure the safety of this ship. The message that comes back is very simple. I am a lighthouse. You choose. So, how do you feel about change? Knowing yourself will help you navigate change because you'll be more equipped to know what are the resources that you need to pull in when circumstances shift for you. And you know, even if we don't like it, we are actually equipped for change. So just shout out, what are some of the things that change in your day, in your week? What changes? Schedules, jobs. Weekly, your job changes. Wow. Good luck with that. Mm-hmm. Health, absolutely. Finances, you bet. The amount of sleep we get changes. Uh-huh. Meals you plan. Moods, I heard. What else? People living in my house and not living in my house and coming back. And yeah, I know those people. Pets. Change. Okay. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Hopefully we grow in that. We change in the awareness of his nature and his character and his provisions and his love. Yeah. On a very small scale, our hair grows. Our cells divide. God has created us as beings who change. And, you know, you can change your profile picture. You can change your lunch plans. The thing that I find most interesting, though, is when I initiate the change, I have perhaps, and probably, a false sense of control. When somebody else initiates a change that impacts my life, I am less likely to be able to just smoothly navigate it. Or there's potential for more sense of what's happening and how do I do this. Whether the change is initiated by me or initiated by you, the internal transition process is actually the same. Sometimes it's very short. Transition is always going on inside of us, whether we acknowledge it, whether we like it, or whether we handle it in a healthy or an unhealthy way. Transition, so the second piece, I would say, navigating transition in a healthy and wholesome and God-honoring, grace-filled way requires that we be authentic grievers, that we have an intentional capacity and daily choosing to grieve well. Now, obviously, there's varying degrees of grief attached to the changes that happen and the circumstances around those changes. And so, just for a completely silly and mundane little example, when I flew into Toronto, and I had a couple days there, and somewhere in the process of unpacking my bag and going to repack my bag, I lost one of my favorite earrings. Now, some of you appreciate the sympathy there. That's a nice sense. Clearly not a catastrophic change in my life. The degree to which I feel it is heightened a little bit by the fact that I didn't actually bring a backup pair. And I'm away from home, and so there's a little bit more intensity, if you will, attached to the loss of that earring. Then you add the fact that it was given to me by a very dear friend of mine. And so now there's an emotional attachment to that. And so what happened when I realized that I had lost the earring? What do you think my first response was? That was the second response. That came later. Pardon? There's sadness in there. That was a little bit further down the road. Initially, I thought, how could I have done this? I am living in one bedroom, using one bathroom. There isn't even physically that much space. And I checked under the bed, and it was just this sense of shock and disbelief, and this can't possibly be happening, which is what we typically experience in the stages of grieving. It's shock, right? It's a sense of denial. And then kicks in, and just so you know, I need to just say, I'm describing these in terms of a progression. Grief is not that clean and tidy. And so while we may experience all of these different things and they may tend to come in this order, they also, we go back and forth and they overlap and there's all kinds of different things that happen. The irritation, the frustration. How could I have possibly done this? And thankfully, it's not huge when we're talking about a lost earring. And then the bargaining piece is another part of grieving. And so the silly thing is, you know, when we're talking about major changes and major losses, then that kicks in. But I could even see it in my thinking about this goofy little earring. And I think, okay, that is a real thing. And then there's this sense of depression. And again, degrees, right? Depending on the kind of loss or change that we're experiencing. And the final stage, the fifth stage, is the place of acceptance. You know what? I'm going to have to carry on here. I will wear a different pair of earrings. And probably, unless I decide to tell this story to 56 women, nobody will even notice what earrings I'm wearing. It's a silly small example, but it is an example of the self-awareness piece that we need to have, that we are able to recognize when a change is causing grief and to what degree of grief it's causing us. And the capacity then, which is the third piece that I think is really important, is that we have a God awareness and that we invite God into that place of grief, whether it's the tiny or whether it's the shock over our son coming home and telling us that we were going to be grandparents, whether it's a job loss, that we have the intentional courage to ask God to come and sit with us in the mess, because I'm sure that if you have grieved and lost, you know that there's nothing clean, there is nothing predictable about grief. My favorite term when I describe grieving is being emotionally ambushed, because it's those things that just pop up that when you least expect it, that you will have this rush of emotion that you didn't see coming. And if we're going to navigate transitions in a healthy way, we need to learn to be comfortable sitting in the mess. It is one of my personal, most difficult pieces of dealing with grief. Because like some of you with the coloring picture said, yeah, I don't really want to color outside the lines. I am actually quite comfortable coloring inside the lines. And so the journey that God continues to take me on has very much to do with saying, I am sovereign God, I choose the lines. And I would like you to live in the present, leaving the outcome up to me. I mentioned when I was speaking at the retreat here at Pine Grove, a book that God brought across my path, which I think is probably one of the most profound and impactful resources that I have come across. And it's called Being Well When We're Ill. And it's a book written by a theologian. And she is, her work and her writing on theology is brilliant. So brilliant that I actually can't read it and understand it. I feel completely overwhelmed by the depth of this woman's knowledge. And then she wrote this book about her journey through medical and physical challenges. And she wed together the spiritual reality of what it is to suffer with physical pain. Because when we live in physical pain, it is not only a physical experience. We are whole beings. And so our physical drastically affects our spiritual and our emotional and our social and our relational and our mental. All of these pieces are connected. And one of the key God awareness pieces, so that's the third thing we need if we're going to transition well in grace-filled and God-honoring ways, is we need to know God. We need an awareness of who God is, his character and his nature. And the more we grow in God awareness, the more we'll grow in self-awareness. And the more we grow in self-awareness, the more we have the potential to grow in God awareness. And what Marva Dawn's book did for me is it changed my questions. So instead of instead of asking, why? God, why is this happening? Marva Dawn encourages us to change the question to where or how or what. Because when I am asking why, what am I really asking? Why me? And how quickly can we go from why me to poor me? Woe is me. Everybody feels sorry for me because I'm feeling sorry for me. I know, I've done it. But when we change our questions and we take why out of the equation, we start asking things like, where are you in the midst of this, Lord? Or we might ask, how do you want me to order this day? What is your purpose for me in this moment, in this circumstance? And one of the things that struck me the most in reading this book is that she said, when I ask why, meaning becomes my idol. I am seeking after understanding and meaning more than I am seeking after God himself. And when I ask how or where or what, I am looking to understand the nature and the character and to know, to have personal connection and relationship with God and his purposes. So in addition to changing my questions, I have had to take a look at my expectations. You know, if expectations was a four-letter word, I think that would be appropriate because a lot of us think of it as something that, well, actually, truthfully, a lot of us just don't think about it. Because we are full of expectations. We just don't necessarily like acknowledging that we have certain expectations. So, if I do an honest appraisal of myself, and I ask God, and I have done this numerous times, what I actually thought my life ought to look like, there were times where I realized that I even had a sense of, I would call it entitlement. This is what I deserve my life to look like. And God says, I have other plans. I have plans to prosper you in ways that are far beyond your understanding. And in order for me to really grasp that, I needed to take a really honest look at what do I expect? What do I think is my right, if you will? And over and over and over again, lay those down before the Lord and ask him to make my expectations in alignment with his expectations. I needed to ask, do my expectations actually line up with Scripture? And perhaps, coming back to what I mentioned earlier, the hardest question is, am I willing to sit with God and grieve where my expectations and my reality don't line up? So this most remarkable thing happened, and it's best captured by Paula Reinhart in a very great book, if you have an opportunity to read it. It's called Better Than My Dreams, and I believe I shared this quote with the people at the retreat, but I think it is worth sharing again for those who weren't there. People who have let go of their expectations of how they think life is supposed to look usually stumble upon gratitude, which is a wonderful thing to find. You stop waiting for life to begin when it's fixed and all the broken parts are healed. It's now, in this moment, this conversation, this sunset. And over time, I began to view my circumstances with gratitude. And let me tell you, that is a very intentional choice. Because it is very not my nature to say, I am grateful for living in pain for 4.5 years. And you know what? The truth is, I don't have to be grateful for pain. Because that's just silly. Who really wants pain? But what I can have gratitude for is God's faithfulness in the midst of pain. It's God meeting me in the pain. It's God choosing to use that circumstance as an opportunity to develop skills in writing that I didn't know I had and has become an incredibly wonderful passion and outlet for me. I had to choose to look for God and to look for the good in it. The verses in 1 Thessalonians 5, 16 to 18, rejoice always, pray continually, and give thanks in every circumstance, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. There's two words that jump out at me from those verses, and one is in. So give thanks in every circumstance. The verse actually doesn't say, give thanks after it's all said and done and you see how it turns out and the pain is gone and circumstances are relieved and you're on vacation and it's all good. It isn't about the 2020 vision of hindsight. It's about choosing to make gratitude a spiritual discipline and asking God to give me the capacity to practice it daily. In the coaching profession, we talk about reframing or asking the question, what's another perspective on this? And if you just change your position by a couple of degrees, you can potentially see something very different. And in difficult circumstances, that's what I have been learning to do. And perhaps the word discipline has some negative connotations to it. But discipline in this context is really about a choice. It's really about saying, I want to use a willful act to turn away from my comfortable whining and land instead on a place of thankfulness. The second word that strikes me from that verse is in every circumstance. It doesn't say, give thanks in the circumstances that feel pleasant or comfortable or easy or when you feel happy. It's in all of them. In the midst of those pain years, I wrote an article for the MB Herald, and I wrote this. This is not Pollyanna-ish. I am not fond of the God is good reply, complete with cheesy smile and gloss over approach to adversity. And don't get me wrong, I do believe God is good. I'll tell you why I wrote that in a minute. No, I am advocating an authentic discipline that stares hard into the face of all things difficult and says, in spite of pain, in the midst of suffering, when loss burns to the soul, I give thanks. There was a pastor's wife in my previous years, and it didn't matter what was happening in her life or in the circumstances of her family or the church or whatever. If you asked her genuinely, how are you? Her response was with this big, kind of cheesy smile, God is good. And immediately, what it did is it put up a block. Because there are times where I just wanted her to be real. I just wanted her to acknowledge and be able to feel safe to be able to say, this is really hard. So that's where that peace comes from. God is good, and he is good all the time, and I need to choose to look for ways that his goodness is being revealed, even in difficult circumstances. So, what does transition actually look like? Are you familiar with a trapeze artist? Does everybody know what I mean by a trapeze artist? So there's a platform, and you've got your bar that you hold on to, and then there's somebody or another bar on the other side. And if you're going to be a successful trapeze artist, what do you need to do? There's jump, there's trust, there's the other person hoping that they'll catch you, that the bars are secure. There's all kinds of issues attached to that, aren't there? There's also this very interesting time, and I use that word, interesting. When I jump off the platform holding onto this bar, I swing out, and what do I need to do at that center point? I've got to let go of the bar. And then this bar is coming this way, and somewhere in between there, I'm not holding on to anything tangible. And then I reach out and I grab for the other. And then hopefully I swing over and I land on the other piece. When we are in the throes of internal processing of transition, a lot of times it feels like that space where we are suspended and there's that absence of what was, and the perhaps recognition, but maybe not, of what will be, and we are hanging there. And it, for some, might be very exhilarating. For others, it might be terrifying. Whenever we are in transition, we are taking what was into what will be, but we're also spending some time in this place, and in the career transition industry, we call it the neutral zone, where you're not fully where you were and you're not fully where you're going to be. You're just kind of hanging around. And the feelings that are attached to that, if you look it up, in career transition theory, it's all grieving language. It's that whole process of being willing to sit in the mess and the discomfort of the unknown. There's a quote I came across recently by a gentleman named Jeremy Taylor, and he says, "Remember that what is most important to God is that we submit ourselves and all that we have to Him. This requires that we be willing to endure whatever His will brings to us, to be content in whatever state we are in, and to be ready for change." We actually don't get to know the outcome, and I'm really very grateful for that. I am grateful that I don't foresee the future, and that God is sovereign and that He's got that in control. We also don't know where a particular circumstance will lead us. We don't know if it's going to be something that later on we'll look back and say, wow, that was really a great learning opportunity or a great experience. I want to end with reading you a story. And I'm not sure if Max Licato actually originally wrote it. I have a feeling he didn't. It's a parable, but it's from one of Max Licato's books. And I think it gives a great perspective on having open hands to change, letting go of the outcome, and asking God to change us in the midst of what's going on, and being willing to consider that maybe something that we had in mind is less important, perhaps even insignificant, to what God has in mind. So it's called The Woodcutter's Horse. Once there was an old man who lived in a tiny village. Although poor, he was envied by all, for he owned a beautiful white horse. Even the king coveted his treasure. A horse like this had never been seen before. Such was its splendor, its majesty, its strength. People offered fabulous prices for the steed, but the old man always refused. "This horse is not a horse to me," he would tell them. "It is a person." "How could you sell a person?" "He is a friend, not a possession. How could you sell a friend? The man was poor and the temptation was great, but he never sold the horse. One morning he found that the horse was not in his stable. All the village came to see him. "You old fool," they scoffed. "We told you that someone would steal your horse. We warned you that you would be robbed. You are so poor. How could you ever protect such a valuable animal? It would have been better to have sold him. You could have gotten whatever price you wanted. No amount would have been too high. Now the horse is gone and you've been cursed with misfortune." The old man responded, "Don't speak too quickly. Say only that the horse is not in the stable. This is all we know. The rest is judgment. If I've been cursed or not, how can we know? How can you judge?" The people contested, "Don't make us out to be fools. We may not be philosophers, but great philosophy is not needed. The simple fact that your horse is gone is a curse." The old man spoke again, "All I know is the stable is empty and the horse is gone. The rest, I don't know. Whether it be a curse or a blessing, I can't say. All we can see is a fragment. Who can say what will come next?" The people of the village laughed. They thought the man was crazy. They'd always thought he was a fool. If he wasn't, he would have sold the horse and lived off the money. But instead, he was a poor woodcutter, and the man was still cutting firewood and dragging it out of the forest and selling it. He lived hand to mouth in the misery of poverty. Now he had proven that he was indeed a fool. After 15 days, the horse returned. He hadn't been stolen. He'd run away into the forest. And not only when he returned, he'd brought a dozen wild horses with him. Once again, the village people gathered around the woodcutter and spoke, "Old man, you were right and we were wrong. What we thought was a curse was a blessing. Please forgive us." The old man responded, "Once again, you go too far. Say only that the horse is back. State only that a dozen horses returned with him, but don't judge. How do you know if this is a blessing or not? You see only a fragment. Unless you know the whole story, how can you judge? You read only one page of a book. Can you judge the whole book? You read only one word of a phrase. Can you understand the entire phrase? Life is so vast, yet you judge all of life with one page or one word. All you have is one fragment. Don't say that this is a blessing. No one knows. I am content with what I know. I am not perturbed by what I don't." For the sake of time, I won't read the rest of it, but it goes on with this back and forth of, is it a blessing? Is it a curse? We make judgments too quickly. No one is wise enough to know if it's a blessing or a curse. Only God knows. So we have about 5 minutes left here before we need to end. I am wondering if anybody has any questions that they would like to ask. I'm also wondering, oh, yes. The title of the book is called Being, oh, Better Than My Dreams, Paula Reinhardt. Yes. Yes. Of my book. Well, thank you. It's called Changing Course. Yeah, Stories to Navigate Career and Life Transitions. So it's a collection of, it's taking people through the process of navigating career and life transitions, but it's done with stories of people that I worked with over the 20 years. Is that a question? Yes. Yes. It is. Absolutely. A blurb? Yes. A plug blurb. You bet. So here's my plug blurb for personality. The very beginning of what I talked about when we were dealing with the coloring exercise, one of the things that is key and important to us, it's foundational really to us at Food for the Hungry, is that poverty is about broken relationships. And relationships that need to be redeemed. And one of the key ways that relationships become broken is that we don't understand each other's language. Based on our hard wiring that God has given us, even though we might all speak English, we tend to speak very different languages because what we value, what we care deeply about in terms of those values, how we use our time, how we deal with conflict. All of those pieces are rooted in the hardwiring, which is the inventory that we'll look at tomorrow night, that will give us an ability to understand not only ourselves and how God has created us, so to increase that self-awareness, because that very much affects how we deal with change and how we transition. But there's also then the opportunity to understand other people. So just to give you a quick example, because my kids have grown up with this material, when one of our sons was about 10 years old, he came screaming down the hall, and he was just furious, which was typically not like him. And he just kept going on and on and on about his brother and how ridiculous his brother was being, and he wasn't playing by the rules, and he wasn't doing this, and he wasn't doing that. And all of a sudden, he stopped dead in his tracks, and he looked at me, and he said, "Wait a minute, Mom. Is this a personality style thing?" And you know, my mother heart as a trainer just kind of soared, because I thought, yes. But it was bigger than that. Because what I saw was that his understanding of his own hardwiring and his brother's hardwiring was able to give him a new lens to interpret this person through. And so instead of, "He's doing this to drive me crazy on purpose," it was, and obviously I'm putting words in his mouth, okay, God made my brother different than me, and so I need to figure out how to bridge that, how we can work together. Clearly not his words at age 9.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry I have to cut you off.
That's good. We're at 11.